Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Today was Upasika day, and spent the afternoon exploring a few themes. The theme was on sutta study and recognizing that the teachings that we follow and the Dhamma that we practice it's important that it's grounded in something that is say a little more than our own whims or wishes or the flavor of the moment and whatever's going on in the Dharma scene somewhere, so that these teachings of the Buddha that have been passed on for all these millennia, it really is a timeless teaching and a timeless exposition, in that the Buddha was, of course, motivated to teach out of compassion, and because he tirelessly did that for 45 years, so that there's this body of teachings that have been collected and maintained that represent the expression of an awakened being's insight and understanding into the human condition. I think we're very privileged to be able to have these teachings, and I think it's quite important that we're diligent in doing some study and having a decent handle on the on those teachings, because they're our lineage is not a scholastic one, but we should still have some knowledge of the fundamental teachings. Ajahn Chah would really encourage us to try to put the books down and learn how to read our own hearts. And I think that's quite essential. But even still, like reading our own hearts, we still have to have some understanding and some guidelines and some perspectives, so that we're attuned to what is useful or what's beneficial. And even that, Ajahn Chah, remember him one time saying, you should study this much, sort of just pointing to the end of his little finger, but you should practice this much, take his whole arm. But if you keep at this practice, which you should, and you end up doing it for 40 odd years like me, so, then you end up And even if you're still fairly young in the practice, whether it's a few years or 10 years or something, it's still you get exposure to the teachings. These suttas are important because it does give a certain amount of confidence and faith in these teachings and in this way of practice. I think that's one of the things that is a natural effect. Of course, one has to be a bit patient and recognizing that the teachings that the Buddha gave are recorded in an ancient language, the Pali language, and they've been translated into English. So there is a certain feeling of certain stilted quality to the language, but just to be patient with that, because it's not as if you're it's not supposed to read like a popular novel anyway. Spiritual teachings that are pointing out a way to freedom and liberation, so that they have a certain gravitas to them, and one needs to give the heart some time to be comfortable with the language and with that presentation, so that one is really able to let that Dhamma of the Buddhas lead inwards. That's one of the qualities, of course, when we do the chanting, this open eye ego Dhamma. It's leading inwards, so that being able to read the teachings or hear them read and then draw it into the heart, so that we're seeing, well, how do we transform this heart? How do we understand this sort of mind-heart complex, this human being in the human condition? And because that's what they're for. And as was mentioned this afternoon, the Buddha did point to the fact that there's, say, in the same way that the ocean has just one flavor, the flavor of salt and salty, the flavor of the taste of his teachings is that of liberation, of awakening. So that allowing that flavor to manifest. And so that depends on our own approach to it. Because if it's, say, if there's impatience or just a critical mind that is kind of dissatisfied with whatever it comes in contact with anyway, and then you read teachings and you're just dissatisfied with that, it's just following the same old pattern. If one spends one's life keeping oneself distracted and absorbed in distractions, and one reads the teachings and listens to the teachings in that way, then it doesn't really transform. So we have to really see the one is seeing the value, the purpose, and of course the purpose is always, how do we free the heart from suffering? How do we understand this human condition that is subject to aging, subject to sickness, subject to death, subject to dissolution, subject to loss, to change, to disintegration. Those are natural conditions that are just a part of, that's a part of any condition, plant, mineral, animal. But us being humans, we feel things, and we feel loss, or we feel worry, or we feel fear. And how do we work with that? How do we live with that? How do we create the conditions for our not being bound by that? And of course, part of it's actually seeing that, well, that those conditions are there. That's a reality. And then putting forth the interest and effort to find the means by which we can overcome that. The feeling of sorrow or dis-ease that is so easily a part of our human experience. Of course, the Buddha, rather than just sort of saying, well, you know, get over it, just be happy, or get on with your life, or it's all wonderful anyway. Giving the tools, and I think that's one of the things that's probably attracted all of us, is that the Buddha is incredibly skillful in giving us the tools and the means and the methods of cultivation that will actually uplift the heart and stabilize the heart and give it a sense of confidence and clarity that allows it to really be peaceful and clear. And just thinking of the image that Ajahn Chah gave what we need to do if we want to have experience or taste the fruits of our practice, then we have to cultivate the tree, and what we can do and have to do is prepare the soil, fertilize it, dig it up so that it's aerated, put the seed or the seedling in the ground, water it, care for it so that any threats to it are taken away, bugs are taken away, and then it's going to grow and it's going to produce fruit. But it's going to do it at its own pace. And you can't really force it to bear fruit at your wish and your whim. You just have to let the nature of whatever tree you've planted, whatever fruit tree you've planted, to manifest on its own. So that you're really paying attention to the qualities that are useful to cultivate, and that's today's one of the teachings or one of the suttas that we went over today pointed to things what the Buddha called treasures, the things that are the treasures of human existence that bear fruit in terms of our Dhamma practice, so that faith, saddha, having faith, having confidence, having conviction, and particularly, say, the conviction of that the Buddha was an enlightened being. And in the aspect of learning, studying, sutta, literally listening, hearing the teachings. But of course, the hearing is not just sort of, you know, in one ear and out the other. It's sort of hearing it, listening to it, bringing it into the heart, so that one is contemplating it, investigating it, experimenting with it, testing it out, and seeing what works, what's helpful, what leads to an increase of well-being and wholesome qualities, what leads to a decrease in suffering and unskillful qualities and within oneself. And that's our learning. It's not just learning about the theory and gathering a bunch of knowledge, but actually putting it into practice and learning from how we apply it, listening to our own experience, listening to the response that our heart has to the teaching. It's like when we're just like sitting in meditation, to be able to listen to what the heart is doing. Of course, we have a certain method or technique that we follow, and when we're meditating, practicing, paying attention to the breath. But the response or the fruit of practice doesn't come from just forcing the mind to be attentive to in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. It's sort of, you have to listen to what's the heart doing? What's the mind doing? How's it responding? What's it being drawn to? What's it being shaken and stirred up by? So that there's this inner listening. So there's an external listening in terms of the listening to the listening to teachings, studying, learning. But there's an inner listening that we have to be attentive to, and that's what, of course, one of the qualities that I mean, certainly is a treasure, but it also leads to increased motivation, increased confidence, and increased understanding. It's just quite natural. The Buddha also, as these things called the treasures, the Buddha points to Hiri and Otapa, which are concerned with virtue, saddha, confidence, sila, or virtue, sutta, study, learning, hiri, otapa, also in terms of virtue, in that sense of how does virtue come to fruition? It doesn't come through just wishful thinking or from fear or from rigidly trying to force oneself into a mold. But again, it's the heart has to respond to and be inclined towards an appreciation of the benefits of virtue and the danger that is there when we don't listen to the heart, when we're not attuned to the results of just unskillful, unwholesome habits of body, speech, and mind. it takes us to a place of confusion, or the heart gets clouded, and that's an obstruction. So that the keeping of say a discipline, a training, a faithfulness to virtuous conduct is accomplished through these qualities of Hiri and Otapa, which are Ajahn Jeff translates conscience and concern, but it's also there is this quality of respect, where one respects one's inner potential and the reality that we all, as human beings, are. We prefer to be happy rather than to suffer. And what do we do in order to facilitate that? And even if we're, and whether it's, if, say, five precepts as a layperson, or even, say, the 227 rules as a monk, this is a question that Ajahn Chah had of Ajahn Mun, and that he was overwhelmed by the he was getting really interested in the Vinaya, the discipline, the training, the application of the monastic rules, but then he was seeing, oh, this is incredibly extensive. How do you come to an end of it? How do you even finish that training so that one can have even time for meditation and arising of wisdom? And sort of, there's so much to so many details and nuances of this kind of moral training, and Ajahn Mun said, you know, well, yeah, there's a lot of rules, but the whole purpose of the rules is that they are accomplished through Hiri and Otapa, so that bringing up in the heart this quality of Hiri and Otapa, and again, a moral integrity is what naturally follows. And so that, you know, when we attune ourselves to that both the aspiration towards moral integrity and the benefits that arise from that, then there's a natural inclination that is supported and I say well established. Another aspect of the things that the Buddha pointed to as a treasure is just generosity. And you realize that, you know, on many levels, this aspect of generosity and giving is a major foundation for our growth in the Dhamma. When we're willing to give of ourselves, give of our time, give of our effort, give of our attention, willing to give that to what's worthy, what's worthwhile. That generosity of spirit has a result in the English adage of you reap what you sow. Is very much the case, so that when one really gives oneself and gives of oneself to the Dhamma, we reap the fruits of that, and the heart becomes truly peaceful and clear. And what we end up relinquishing and giving away is our suffering, our discontent, our dissatisfaction. Because the if we operate from a, say, a selfish expectation of trying to get the benefits of virtue, of meditation, of wisdom, of Dhamma practice, trying, so for a coming from more selfish, narrow perspective, it's never satisfying, and we never feel satisfied. But this, when we approach it with a real generosity, giving ourselves to it, then we find ourselves, wherever we are, contented and peaceful. It's this, the attitude is really critical. So that, as a treasure that bears fruit in the Dhamma, that cultivation and establishing oneself in the word is chaka, and generosity and open-handedness, that bears great fruit. It's the last quality that the Buddha points to is banya, or discernment, understanding, wisdom. So the seeing clearly. What comes to mind is the words that are used to describe the fundamental insight that changes, transforms from the mundane to the transcendent, transforms us from the kind of the bound by samsara to established in liberation, that quality of say yatha bhuta jnana dasanam, sort of knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. So it isn't as if we have to come up with anything new or invent something really dazzling and fascinating, but to really see clearly the way things actually are. And the way that the Buddha describes, this treasure of discernment and wisdom, is that the knowledge and understanding of arising and passing away. Understanding that fundamental, they understand the importance of that fundamental pattern of all things, whether it's external or internal, material or of materiality or mentality, whether it's coarse or refined, just seeing that whatever has the nature to arise, that also has the nature to cease. And whether it evokes pleasure or pain, whether we approve of it or disapprove of it, this is its nature. And so rather than personalizing whatever it is, whether it's pleasant or painful, making it about me and enhancing the story of me, now this is just a pattern of nature. This is a natural phenomenon. And we can keep coming back to that knowledge of this has the nature to arise, it has the nature to cease. It comes into being and it passes away. And we don't need to get entangled, we don't need to create a problem out of it, we don't have to make it into something exotic or special to fit into our storyline about it. This is the way things are. And, there's an evenness or a steadiness or a stability that one experiences when one sees things with that kind of clarity. And I think that was one of the things that really attracted so many of us Westerners when we met Ajahn Chah. We went to his monastery and witnessed him, his presence, and his engagement and with the world around him, whether it was the, say, the monastery or the society around. And he was just always a still center, a still presence, a steady presence within that, within whatever was going on. And just so many of us, I'm sure, it was just that feeling. And it might not have even been articulated, this sort of, you know, wow, whatever he's got, I want some of that. And you know, that's really steady, solid. But it isn't just a result that you or a quality that you try to force in yourself. There's a reason for that, and the reason is that knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. So to be able to reflect, to investigate, to discern, to understand clearly what things are in their true nature, so that all these different qualities weave together and support each other and lay the basis for this clarity, this independence, so that those are a few of the things that we that are still rattling around in my mind after Upasika day today. So I'll offer it for reflection.